Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, as Pakistan demands that the U.S. stop bombing it from the sky, Chris Hedges speaks of what war does to the minds of those on the ground, including the soldiers. I hope you'll stay tuned. I'm an old English major, so I'm deeply interested in the connections among the world and our understanding and compositions of words. I like nonfiction even more than fiction. Today we'll hear from a master of nonfiction words, Chris Hedges. Hedges is the son of a clergyman, of an unusually liberal Presbyterian minister. Chris himself got a divinity degree from Harvard, but was never ordained. Instead, he became a very respected foreign correspondent, for the most part a war correspondent. He worked for some fine newspapers, including 15 years at the New York Times. The Times fired him for speaking out against the Iraq War, not in his reporting, but off duty on his own time. Hedges has kept writing and kept speaking out on public policy. His words sound like they come from a clergyman, and they sound like they come from a veteran journalist. Today, we'll hear that prophetic voice speaking on a topic he knows all too well, war. Since I was born in 1950, the United States has been continuously at war in one third world country or another. We are awash in blood, most of it the blood of innocent people. When the government does it, none dare call it bloody murder. Hedges has covered some recent wars, all of which our country at least had a hand in. El Salvador, Yugoslavia, Gulf War I, and the Israeli attacks on Gaza. When Hedges writes about war, his focus is not on the general's strategies or the political goals of the conflict. His focus is on the ground, where the bullets are slamming into flesh, and people are crushed beneath collapsing buildings, and even the soldiers are feeling more and more traumatized. He describes the lives of people on the receiving end of war, and that includes civilians and soldiers, and also himself and his fellow journalists. In 2002, Hedges published a good, slim book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Today, we'll hear a talk that discusses many of the issues from that book. It's about the attractive, addictive pull of war. War addicts people as it destroys them psychologically. War is like heroin. First, though, let's hear Hedges talk about an earlier war, World War II. The good war, the establishment loves to call it, and how this war affected some of the American soldiers who fought it and survived it. Here, Hedges is asked if his father had been radicalized in the 1930s, and Hedges replies, no.
I think my father was, like many of his generation, radicalized by World War II. We've mythologized World War II. He and most of my uncles were in the war. I had one uncle that was physically and emotionally destroyed in the South Pacific, drank himself to death in a trailer. I mean, and I think that that wasn't uncommon with combat vets who suffered from what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder. There was no name for it then, and very little understanding or sympathy. So even though my uncle, for instance, mailed all of his medals back to the Pentagon, he hated war. He was destroyed by war. In our family, he was an embarrassment. I mean, there was no alcohol in the manse where I grew up, and yet my uncle was a drunk. I think there were probably tens of thousands of families who were caring for people who had been psychologically and physically maimed, but they were shunted aside because they didn't fit that kind of mythic narrative. And I really grew up because of that in the shadow of World War II. The shadow of the war fell upon my family.
So much for the good war. Now, onto the wars that we remember. Here is Chris Hedges speaking of how war is a force that gives us meaning.
We can from the safety of the United States, thrill in the perversity of war, even as we watch films or read books that are meant to denounce war. It is almost impossible to produce anti-war films or books or documentaries that also present images of battle. It is like trying to condemn pornography while showing erotic love scenes. The prurient fascination with violent death always overpowers the message. There is a film by the French filmmaker René Clément called Le Jeu Interdit, or Forbidden Games. It is about two children who play war games in France in World War II. During the entire film, they bury things. They are obsessed with death, but there is only one scene when they are fleeing with a column of French refugees and are attacked by German planes when we see images of battle. In that scene, the little girl's parents are killed. She is told her parents have been buried. She imagines her mother and father under the earth. The boy and the orphan girl are shown in the village, and all they do is bury dolls, dead bugs, animals, until they have to create corpses to bury. Their lives, their focus, their actions are concerned only with death. This, for me, is an insight into the brutalizing effect of war, what it does to culture, to children, and to civilization. Death is inherent to war. Yet we are sadly unaware of how war distorts us, how it brings out within us the morbid, the brutal, the macabre. We embrace instead the abstract words of glory, honor, courage, patriotism that mask the reality of war. Abstract words that in combat are not only rendered hollow, but obscene. War is part of the modern industrial landscape. Indeed, its tools are often the cutting edge of technology. By World War I, we had created ways in which thousands of people who never saw their attackers could die in an instant. And weapons that carry out this impersonal mass slaughter are beautiful. They are crafted, sleek, and harbor within them awesome power. The machines of war, the planes, the tanks, the heavy machine guns, the huge hulking howitzers and the helicopters are pieces of art. I have seen them at work. They are angels of death streaking through the sky. I was with a unit of guerrillas in El Salvador when some Huey helicopters raced in over a lake to hunt us down. We hid in the ruins of an abandoned village, darting from wall to wall and standing with our backs to the shattered bricks so our hunters could not see us as they passed low overhead. Yet even as I looked up at these machines that were trying to kill me, I found them seductive. Once in a conflict, once we live in the midst of the fighting, we are moved from the abstract to the real, from the mythic to the sensory. No soldier after a few seconds of combat believes in the myth of war anymore. And this is why wounded Marines jeered John Wayne when he visited them in a hospital in World War II. When this move takes place, we have nothing to do with a world not at war. The world, when we return to it, is viewed always from the end of a very long tunnel. There they still believe. There they do not understand. We feel different, wiser, greater. And this experience is so overpowering that if we can control our fear, we go back to seek it out again. War is addictive. Indeed, it is the most potent narcotic invented by humankind. The first time I was in an ambush was in the Salvadoran town of Suchitoto. It was a dreary peasant outpost made up of stucco and mud and wattle huts off the main road. The town was surrounded by the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front rebels, who, when I arrived in El Salvador, were winning the war. The government forces kept a small garrison in the town, although its relief columns were frequently ambushed as they ambled down the small strip of asphalt surrounded by high grass. It was one of the most dangerous spots in the country. The rebels launched an attack to take the town. A convoy of reporters in cars marked with TV and masking tape on the windshields hightailed it to the small bridge that led to the lonely stretch of road into Suchitoto. We stopped for the familiar ritual of getting high, something as a print reporter who could scramble to safety I did not do, but something the photographers who would stand and take pictures found a necessary balm to their nerves. Then we moved slowly down the road, the odd round fired ahead or behind us. We made it to the edge of town, where we ran into rebel units, now accustomed to the follies of the press. On foot, we moved through the deserted streets. The firing from the garrison became louder as we weaved our way with rebel units to the siege that had been set up. Then, as I rounded a corner, several full bursts of automatic fire rent the air. Bullets hit the mud wall behind me. We dove into the dirt. The rebels began to fire noisy rounds from their M16 assault rifles. The scent of cordite filled the air. Rebels around me were wounded, crying out in pain. One died, yelling in a sad cadence for his mother, his desperate and final plea slicing through the absurd posturing of soldiering. At first, his cries haunted me. Soon, I just wished he would be quiet. The firefight seemed to go on for eternity. I cannot say how long I lay there. It could have been a few minutes. It could have been an hour. Here was war, real war, sensory war, not the mythic war of movies and novels I had consumed in my youth. It was horrifying, confusing, numbing, and nothing like the myth I had been peddled. I realized at once that it controlled me. I would never control it. In a lull, I made a dash across an empty square to find shelter behind a house. My heart was racing. Adrenaline coursed through my bloodstream, but I was safe. I made it back to the capital and, like most war correspondents, soon considered the experience a great cosmic joke. I drank away the fear in a seedy bar in downtown San Salvador that night. Most people, after such an experience, would learn to stay away. I was hooked. Drawn into the world of war, it becomes hard to escape. It perverts and destroys you. It pushes you closer and closer to your own annihilation, spiritual, emotional, and finally physical. I covered the war in El Salvador from 1983 to 1988. By the end, I had a nervous twitch in my face. I was evacuated 3 times by the U.S. Embassy because of tips that the death squads planned to kill me. Yet each time, I came back. I accepted with a grim fatalism that I would be killed in El Salvador. I could not articulate why I accepted my own destruction and cannot now. There came to be a part of me, maybe it is a part in all of us, which decided I would rather die like this than go back to the dull routine. During the war in El Salvador, I worked with a photographer who covered the war, had a slew of close calls, and then called it quits. He moved to Miami and took pictures of tepid domestic stories for one of the news weeklies. But life in Florida was flat, dull, uninteresting. He could not adjust and soon came back. From the moment he stepped off the plane, it was clear he had returned to die. And just as there are some soldiers or war correspondents that seem to us immortal, and whose loss comes as a sobering reminder that death has no favorites, there are also those in war who are locked in a grim embrace with death from which they cannot escape. He was frightening to behold, a walking corpse. He was shot through the back in a firefight and died in less than a minute. Sigmund Freud divided the forces in human nature between the Eros instinct, the impulse within us that propels us to become close to others, to preserve and conserve, and the thanatos, or death instinct, the impulse that works towards the annihilation of all living things, including ourselves. For Freud, these forces were in eternal conflict. He was therefore pessimistic about ever eradicating war. All human history, he argued, in civilization and its discontents is a tug of war between these two instincts. Taste enough of war, and you come to believe the Stoics were right. We will, in the end, all consume ourselves in a vast conflagration. There is a constant search in war to find new perversities, new forms of death when the initial flush fades, a rear guard, and finally futile effort to ward off the boredom of routine death. And this is why we would drive into towns in Bosnia and find bodies crucified on the sides of barns or decapitated and mutilated. This is why those slain in combat are treated as trophies belonging to the killers, turned into grotesque pieces of performance art. I know soldiers that to this day carry in their wallets the identity cards of men they know they killed. They take them everywhere. They show them to you with the imploring look of a lost child. They will never understand. The job of killing allows our senses to command our bodies. The killing whips fighters into greater orgies of destruction. Hedonism and perversion spirals out of control. Those who worked hard all their lives are reviled as dupes and fools. They haunt the soup kitchens. The loyalty they express to the state or to the institutions they worked for has left them beggars. They collect pensions when they are paid that amount to a few dollars. The normal order is turned upside down. Decency, sobriety, and honesty, moderation no longer pay. Better to give yourself up to the lust of war. In war, we deform ourselves, our essence. We give up individual conscience, maybe even consciousness, for the contagion of the crowd, the rush of patriotism, the belief that we must stand together as a nation in moments of extremity, to make a moral choice, to defy war's enticement, and to defend love can become self-destructive. But in the rise to power, we always become smaller. Power absorbs us, and once power is obtained, we are its pawn. As in Shakespeare's Richard III, the all-powerful prince who molded the world, we fall prey to the forces we thought we had harnessed. Love may not always triumph, but it keeps us human. It offers the only chance to escape from the contagion of war. Perhaps it is the only antidote, and there are times when remaining human is the only victory possible. When the mask of war slips away and the rot and corruption is uncovered, when it turns sour and rank, when the myth is exposed as a fraud, we feel soiled and spent. It is then that we sink into despair. In the Arab-Israeli 1973 war, almost a third of all Israeli casualties were due to psychiatric causes, and the war lasted only a few days. A World War II study determined that after 60 days of continuous combat, 98% of all surviving soldiers will have become psychiatric casualties. And a common trait among the 2% who were able to endure sustained combat was a predisposition towards aggressive, psychopathic personalities. During the war in El Salvador, soldiers could serve in the army for 3 or 4 years or longer, virtually until they psychologically or physically collapsed. In garrison towns, commanders banned the sale of sedatives because of the abuse by troops. In this war, the emotionally maimed were common. I interviewed a 19-year-old Salvadoran army sergeant who had spent 5 years fighting and suddenly lost his vision after his unit walked into a rebel ambush. The rebels killed 11 soldiers in the firefight, including his closest friend. A couple dozen soldiers were wounded. He was unable to see again until he was placed in the army hospital. "I have these horrible headaches," he told me, sitting on the edge of his bed. "There is shrapnel in my head. I keep telling the doctors to take it out." But the doctors told me he had no head wounds. I have seen soldiers in other conflicts go deaf or stop speaking or simply shake without being able to stop. War is necrophilia. And this necrophilia is central to soldiering just as it is central to the makeup of suicide bombers and terrorists. It is hidden under platitudes about duty and comradeship, but it waits, especially in moments when we seem to have little to live for and no hope, or in moments when the intoxication of war is at its pitch to be unleashed. When we spend long enough in war, it comes to us as a kind of release, a fatal and seductive embrace that can consummate the long flirtation with our own destruction. In Milo Vangelis's memoir of the partisan war in Yugoslavia, he wrote of the enticement death held for the combatants. He stood over the body of his comrade, the commander Sava Kovekovich, and found, Dying did not seem terrible or unjust. This was the most extraordinary, the most exalted moment of my life. Death did not seem strange or undesirable. That I restrained myself from charging blindly into the fray and death was perhaps due to my sense of obligation to the troops or to some comrade's reminder concerning the tasks at hand. In my memory, I returned to those moments many times with the same feeling of intimacy with death and desire for it while I was in prison, especially during my first incarceration. When we see this, when we see our addiction for what it is, when we understand ourselves and how war has perverted us, life becomes hard to bear. John Steele, a cameraman who spent years in war zones, had a nervous breakdown in a crowded Heathrow airport in 1994 after returning from Sarajevo. He understood the reality of his work, a reality that stripped away the self-righteous, high-octane gloss. "I came back from Sarajevo," he said in an interview. "We were in a place called Sniper's Alley. I filmed a girl there who had been hit in the neck by a sniper's bullet. I filmed her in the ambulance, and only after she was dead, I suddenly understood that the last thing she had seen was the reflection of the lens of the camera I was holding in front of her face. This wiped me out. I grabbed the camera and I started running down Sniper's Alley, filming at knee level the Bosnians running from place to place." A year after the war in Sarajevo, I sat with Bosnian friends who had suffered horribly. A young woman, Liliana, had lost her father, a Serb, who refused to join the besieging Serb forces around the city. She had been forced a few days earlier to identify his corpse. The body was lifted, the water running out of the sides of a rotting coffin from a small park for reburial in the central cemetery. She was emigrating for Australia soon, where she told me, "I will marry a man who has never heard of this war and raise children that will be told nothing about it, nothing about the country I am from." Liliana was young, but the war had exacted a toll. Her cheeks were hollow, her hair dry and brittle. Her teeth were decayed and some had broken into jagged bits. She had no money for a dentist. She hoped to fix them in Australia. Yet, all she and her friends did that afternoon was lament the days when they lived in fear and hunger, emaciated, targeted by Serb gunners on the heights above. They did not wish back the suffering, and yet they admitted these may have been the fullest days of their lives. They looked at me in despair. I knew them when they were being pounded by hundreds of shells a day, when they had no water to bathe in or wash their clothes, when they huddled in unheated apartments as sniper bullets hit the walls outside. But what they expressed was real. It was the disillusionment with a sterile, futile, and empty present. Peace had again peeled back the void the rush of war, of battle, had filled. Once again they were, as perhaps we all are, alone, no longer bound by that common sense of struggle, no longer given the opportunity to be noble, heroic, no longer sure what life was about or what it meant. The old comradeship, however false, that allowed them to love men and women they hardly knew, indeed whom they may not have liked before the war, had vanished with the last shot. Moreover, they had seen that all the sacrifice had been for naught. They had been, as we all are in war, betrayed. The corrupt old Communist Party bosses, who became nationalists overnight and got them into the mess in the first place, had grown rich off their suffering and were still in power. There was a 70% unemployment rate. They depended on handouts from the international community. They knew the lie of war, the mockery of their idealism, and struggled with their shattered illusions. They understood that their cause, once as fashionable in certain intellectual circles as they were themselves, lay forgotten. No longer did actors, politicians, and artists scramble to come and visit during the ceasefires, acts that were almost always ones of gross self-promotion. And yet, they wished it all back, and I did too. A year later, I received a Christmas card. It was signed Liliana from Australia. It had no return address. I never heard from her again. But many of those I worked with as war correspondents during the past 20 years did not escape. They could not break free from the dance with death. They wandered from conflict to conflict, seeking always one more hit. By then, I was back in Gaza and found myself pinned down in another ambush. A young Palestinian 15 feet away from me was shot through the chest and killed. I had been lured back, but now felt none of the old rush, just fear. It was time to break free, to let go, to accept that none of this would or could or should come back. I knew then that it was over. I was lucky to get out alive. Kurt Schork, brilliant, courageous, and driven, could not let go. He died in an ambush in May of 2000 in Sierra Leone, along with another friend, Miguel Gil Moreno. His entrapment, his embrace of thanatos, of the death instinct, was never questioned at the sterile and antiseptic memorial service staged for him in Washington. Everyone tiptoed around it, but for those of us who knew him, we understood that he had been consumed.
Chris Hedges. And for the audio, I thank my friend and fellow radio guy, Robin Upton. From sunny Bangladesh, of all places, Robin produces the weekly two-hour radio show, Unwelcome Guests. You can check that out at unwelcomeguests.net. And you can catch up on our own shows at our own website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, and I thank you for listening to New World Notes. Illegitimae non carborundum. Please come back again next week, and please remember, war is not healthy for children and other living things. Ciao.